From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The fracturing of the Republican Party continued over the weekend as Donald Trump, the apparent GOP presidential nominee, said he would not rule out blocking Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan from serving as chairman of the Republican convention this summer, all while the Never Trump movement looks desperately for a willing third-party candidate. We are staring at a stunning crack-up in the heart of the GOP. And the Democrats, plenty of deep tensions there as well, after millions have felt the burn for Bernie Sanders. This hour on Point, the great and unfinished political realignments of 2016 and what they mean for the future of American politics. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do these two parties still work for you, for the voters, for the future? What changes do you see coming? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Jamel Bowie, chief political correspondent for Slate. Jamel, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. Also from Washington, Molly Ball joins us, political staff writer for The Atlantic. Her article last Wednesday, the day after Donald Trump all but clinched the Republican nomination, was headlined, "The Day the Republican Party Died." Molly Ball, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Great to be here, as always.
And from Milwaukee, Julia Azari joins us, professor of political science at Marquette University, contributor to 538 and Vox, author of Delivering the People's Message. Julia Azari, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Molly, can we go to your headline first? The day the Republican Party died? What? Really?
Well, one is allowed to be a little bit hyperbolic in headlines, but and I don't mean to compare Donald Trump to Buddy Holly. Someone suggested that that was the implication. But, you know, the idea is that the Republican Party, as we previously knew it, feels to a lot of its adherents to be a thing of the past now. It feels like a sort of permanent breakage in this thing that a lot of conservative intellectuals have been building for decades. There are a lot of people who sincerely believed in this project of building a party of ideas, a party of conservative ideas, a governing agenda for the right. They feel that Trump has smashed that and that what he stands for is antithetical to everything that they've tried to build. So in a really unprecedented way over the past week, we have seen a lot of the Republican Party's sort of strongest adherents abandoning the party, whether it's changing their voter registration, declaring that the party no longer represents them. This is not normal, even after a bitterly contested primary.
So what exactly is broken? What's the old ideology as of like 5 minutes ago that is now not maybe operative if Donald Trump is the Republican standard bearer?
Well, think about the party of Ronald Reagan, who, of course, is a demigod to everybody, to most of the, or was thought to be, to the Republican Party, the three-legged stool of conservatism that he espoused, which was a sort of muscular internationalist foreign policy. Trump has said a lot of contradictory things on foreign policy, but his view is America first. The second leg of the stool
come
is
home,
social.
Don't get caught up in all this adventuring abroad, or as much anyway, I guess.
Right. Now, it's not actually true that he opposed the Iraq War before it started, but he has tried to claim a sort of anti-war perspective in this particular race and has been harshly critical in retrospect of the war. The second leg of the stool is social conservatism and a devotion to traditional family values. Most people do not believe that Donald Trump is firmly in that camp, whatever he says now. And the third leg is economic conservatism, a belief in unfettered free markets, free from government regulation. Trump, again, has said a lot of contradictory things, but he says he would not cut in Social Security and Medicare, as conservatives like Paul Ryan believe needs to be done for the fiscal health of the country. And he would consider raising taxes on the rich, which, again, most Republicans oppose.
What would it mean that Donald Trump has said over the weekend that Paul Ryan can't necessarily be chairman of the convention of the GOP?
What would it mean? I mean, well, a nominee usually is granted the prerogative to sort of shape the party in his image. But the question is whether is if Trump does that, how many Republicans who previously were on board with what the party stood for will be on board for that that sort of personality transplant that Trump is going to engineer?
Jamel Bowie, you know, we always humans kind of assume that what has been will be. But this campaign season says maybe not.
Do you see the Republican Party having just a little time out while Donald Trump does his thing and then it's back to business as usual, the Reagan ideology, and on it goes? Or can you picture something more fundamental and maybe even permanent happening here, a transformation of the party's outlook, a split, a death, as Molly's headline would have it?
I mean, obviously, everything depends on the outcome of this fall's election. You know,
Does it really? Because something's happened already. Something very big's happened. Or you're saying if Donald Trump doesn't win, they'll sweep him aside and be back to the same old, same old?
Well, no, I think, you know, if Donald Trump, let's say Donald Trump loses in a landslide, that he can't break 40% of the vote, that Hillary Clinton, unlikely Democratic nominee, ends up, you know, sweeping in the largest victory Democrats have seen in a long time, that would signal, I think, two things. The first is that to Donald Trump's supporters, to sort of Trumpites in the Republican Party, that this message may not actually be nationally viable, that this kind of hyper-focus on sort of resentful white voters won't bring you close to a national majority, but it will mobilize other groups against you. And the second thing, for sort of his opponents in the Republican Party, it would basically signal that this is like a black swan event, that for a variety of reasons, Donald Trump pops up, he loses badly, but we can sort of essentially, now that he's lost so badly, we can take over again. That's one possible path from like a big Donald Trump loss. But the reverse, right, is that Donald Trump performs like, say, Mitt Romney or even John McCain, which is he, you know, clears 45% of the vote, maybe gets up to 47-48%, then that signals that this is actually a very viable approach to kind of changing and moving the Republican Party. And then I think you do see the emergence of, you know, maybe not Trump in style, but Trump in message Republicans who are adopting this idea of sort of government benefits for a select group of Americans, anti-immigrant politics, mm-hmm. Anti-Muslim politics, and so on and so forth. And so I think, you know, we'll be able to tell, A, depending on what happens in November, and then after that, by the 2018 midterms, what kind of candidates have emerged in the wake of all of this. But I think at this moment, it's a bit too early to say what exactly happens to the Republican Party. I'll say that, you know, when I think a party dying, right, I think of the Whig Party. I think of a party literally collapsing and no longer existing as an institution. I think the Republican Party will likely endure, but what that Republican Party looks like is very different.
Of course,
maybe very different.
Yeah, of course, that's a pretty big deal. And in fairness, what Molly wrote was, were you there the night Donald Trump killed the Republican Party as we knew it?
Right.
The nameplate can stay on, but what's under the hood could be quite different from the Reagan orthodoxy that really has ruled now for decades. I want to look at the Democrats, but let's stick with the Republicans because they've got plenty of tensions there as well. But let's stick with the Republicans for a minute. Julia Azari in Milwaukee, you've got the historical perspective on this, going back, a couple of hundred years that we've seen major upheavals, but only rarely in American politics. Do you see enough horsepower in whatever's going on in the GOP this time, Julia, to transform this party, to leave it a different party on the other side of this campaign season?
So that's a great question. I've been thinking a lot about whether this means that that the Republican Party will split either for a couple cycles or like as Molly's piece suggested for a long time. And I keep going back to this idea. In the piece that I wrote on 538, I was looking at historical party splits, and one of the things that drives that is if the South is in your coalition, you end up having a division between the southern wing of the party and whatever other region makes up the party coalition.
Okay, and what does that mean in 2016?
Right. So in 2016, what that means, if you look at the map, the Republican Party is the South and the West, and the West tended to go for Cruz, not totally, but heavily, and the South tended to go for Trump. But, you know, so this kind of looks like what's happened in the Democratic Party historically over a whole bunch of different cycles is the Northern and Southern Democrats would split over major political issues, over slavery, over civil rights. So this time we don't have that kind of like one big pressing dominant issue. But on the other hand, there's also kind of nowhere for this wing of the party to go. And if Northern Republicans and Western Republicans are serious that they don't want anything to do with some of the claims that Trump and his supporters have made, then I think that's the basis for a deeper split. And there's nowhere for that faction to go because they're not going to join the Democratic coalition. And that could be a much more significant fracturing than we've seen in a long time.
Molly, we just got a minute before the break, but do you, if it died, as we've known it, last whatever it was, Tuesday night, do you see the outlines of something new and different taking its place? What?
I have no idea. I'm just going to be honest with you. I have no idea where this goes. It's a very interesting and uncertain and exciting moment. And I just wanted to pick up on something that I think Jamel and Julia were both sort of talking around, which is the real problem for these Republican elites who believed in Reaganism is the voters. What they have learned and what they can't unsee now is that the philosophy they were peddling was not what their voters wanted. And so when you have a party whose voters have signaled that they prefer a completely different agenda than the establishment was pushing, I don't see how you reconcile that and everybody comes back in the tent even if there is a loss.
Those voters sitting right there saying, wait a minute. And in many states and in many ways, and Donald Trump now on his way, it appears, to the Republican nomination. We thought it'd be a contested convention. Even that not happening. We'll hear from Donald what he's been saying lately about all this, ideology, orthodoxy, and the rest. And we will look at the Democrats, where you've got millions now who have felt the burn for Bernie Sanders. Will they bring that home to the Democratic Party as we've known it? The Democratic Party under the sort of Clinton, decades? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what is next for American politics and our two-party system, asking if we're in the midst of a fundamental realignment, and if we are, what it might look like for the GOP, for the Democrats, on the other side. Jamel Bowie is with us, chief political correspondent for Slate. Molly Ball is here, political staff writer at The Atlantic. Julia Azari is with us from Marquette in Milwaukee. And you can join us. Do you see a fundamental realignment going on in this country with the passion and votes for Trump and Sanders? Will the Republican Party have to be reborn to keep up with what voters are saying here? Will the Democrats have to do the same somehow? Can these old parties make the change that's being demanded? The most acute symptoms on the Republican side. Here was South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham just Friday telling CNN's Dana Bash he will not vote for Donald Trump as president. Not a conservative.
I just don't believe Donald Trump is a reliable conservative Republican. Good luck with Paul Ryan trying to find a conservative agenda with this guy. And I don't think he has the temperament or judgment to be commander-in-chief. A lot of my colleagues will vote for him enthusiastically. Some will hold their nose. I just can't go there with Donald.
Can't go there. Here's Trump yesterday with George Stephanopoulos saying, hey, it's the Republican Party, not the conservative party. Implication? It can change.
So I'm going to get Bernie people to vote because they like me on trade. I have to stay true to my principles also. And I'm a conservative. But don't forget, this is called the Republican Party. It's not called the Conservative Party. You know, there are conservative parties. It's called the Republican Party. Does the party have to be together? Does it have to be unified? I'm very different than everybody else, perhaps, that's ever run for office. I actually don't think so. I think that...
It doesn't have to be unified?
No, I don't think so.
Donald Trump, Republican Party, doesn't have to be conservative and doesn't have to be united. That is a new party. Big people in that realm, really unhappy. Bill Kristol, editor of the Conservative Weekly Standard, told CNN last Thursday he's looking for a third-party candidate, specifically named Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, both Republicans who have been critical of Trump as potential third-party contenders.
Sasse, Haley, Sasse, they're both fine with me. No, I would like there to be an independent Republican candidate because I can't support Trump and I can't support Clinton.
Could something like that happen on the Democratic side? Donald Trump would be just fine with that. Victory rally in New York last month, here he was saying, hey, Bernie Sanders ought to run as an independent.
I really mean it. I think Bernie Sanders should run as an independent. I think he'd do great.
We are in some kind of crazy territory here, or maybe just what Americans now want. Jose in Marianna, Georgia. Thank you for calling, Jose. You're on the air.
The most important thing Trump has done is expose how vacuous the groups that comprise the Republican Party are, if you think about it. They pasted together all these disparate groups, you know, like we're going to appeal to people that don't have much of an education and don't believe in evolution. They don't believe in, you know, climate change. You know, people just don't believe in scientific stuff. We're going to be holding up to them, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, this is, you know, finally a result of all that stuff coming apart. Now, I believe Trump is going to come up with some incredible announcements. I believe he's going to ask for the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate Hillary Clinton. He's going to ask that special prosecutor be Ken Starr, just like it was before.
Bring it all back? Oh, I'm having a nightmare already. Please, don't take me back. You may be right. He will go for drama in the general election if he follows the pattern of the primary election. Jose, let me pick up your main point there and take it to you, Molly. I mean, the kind of implication that the GOP built its own crack-up by stoking angers that were not actually central to the core ideology of the elite who've been kind of looking over it.
I mean, that is a disturbing prospect for a lot of these sort of Republican establishmentarians and Republican intellectuals that I talk to. All these years, they've been hearing liberals accuse them of basically, you know, either manipulating the rubes the way the caller described, or, you know, stoking latent racism and xenophobia and antipathy to progress among their followers. That was sort of what was behind the mask of this sort of presentable Reaganite ideology. For years, a lot of, I think, very sincere Republicans insisted that was not what the party is about, and now they face the disturbing prospect that the liberals were right about them.
Don in Whetstone, Kentucky. Don, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I'm one of those rubes, hillbilly misogynist racist from down here in Appalachia.
We're not necessarily buying that, Don. How do you see what's going on?
Okay. Hey, here's what I'm saying. If you vote for Trump, could it not just be that you're a working dude who got destroyed by NAFTA like my old man? Couldn't it just be like you're one of my uncles who can't dig coal anymore because Obama won't let him? Can he not just be a family guy who's got three kids and he's trying to support, who knows that the TPP is just going to destroy more jobs? Can he not just be a guy working for a wage that you know is probably $3 less on the hour because there's illegal labor all over the country? I mean, where's common sense? I mean, I wonder if Bill Kristol, I wonder how much coal he's dug in his life. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I can.
16-hour shifts as he worked in a factory,
yeah,
making $11 an hour. I couldn't care less what these fools had to say.
Let me ask you something, Don. Are you committed to the Republican Party? With that view of what's going on, people say, well, no one could swing from the GOP to Bernie Sanders, but you sound like you might.
Look, I'm a working man. Yep. I work 13, 14 hours every day. I got two jobs. I got three kids. I got a wife.
Yep.
You know, I'm not a misogynist. I got a mom. I like her.
Yep.
I got sisters. I like them.
Yep.
I got a wife. I really like her. So I like ladies. I like women. I try to take care of them as best I can.
Yep.
No, I've always voted Republican, and I vote Democrat on the state level because federal Democrats are out of their minds.
Okay.
But so are Republicans on the federal level now. I don't care what party it is. Trump's a blowhard Yankee moron. I get it. But he's against NAFTA. He's against the TPP. He doesn't want to play Empire. Pat Buchanan likes him. Good enough for me.
Don, call again. It's good to hear from you. Jamel, run with that. Don says, look, this is common sense, and maybe if you're up there in Washington, the tip-top of the elite there, it looks all wrong. But when you're down where, you know, working dudes like his dad are being destroyed, have been, you're open to something else. You're hungry for it.
You know, Don makes a bunch of really interesting points, but the thing that strikes me is that something like 40 to 42% of America's working class, people with high school diplomas or lower, people who do not have white collar jobs, who are doing blue collar or service work, about 40 to 42% of those people are African American, Latino, or Asian American.
Okay.
And so what that implies is that if Trump were just speaking for the working man or the working person, this is nothing more than working people being upset and angry with the direction the country has taken,
okay,
then you would expect Trump to have a much more diverse coalition behind him.
Yep.
But he doesn't. Trump's coalition is almost entirely white, and while he has won sort of the majority of the Hispanic vote in states like Nevada, the Hispanic GOP vote is so small that amounts to just a couple thousand people. So, you know, I don't think, I think two things can be true.
Okay.
The first is that there are many, specifically white workers who feel that the party they traditionally support, the Republican Party, is not attuned to their interests, and so they're supporting someone like Donald Trump who is. It is, can also be true that Donald Trump is not actually attuned to the interests of working people writ large, because the interests of working people writ large include many things beyond simply economic agreements like NAFTA or TPP. They include things like racial injustice and immigration and so on and so forth. And for those people, a substantial minority of the working class, and as time goes on, soon a majority of the working class, Trump is dangerous. He's threatening to their interests.
What about the possibility, Jamel, that despite how far Don describes people in his neck of the woods have been beaten down, that maybe because they're white and the history of privilege, despite how far they've been beaten down, has come with it, maybe they feel entitled to stand up and demand better.
I think that this is one of those things that is sort of below the surface. You know, I don't think anyone necessarily consciously thinks that, but I do think that people look at their past. They look at their past life. They see people like their father and their grandfather, their mother and their grandmother, who work hard, who are able to support children and support a family, and they can no longer do that in the same way. And they see, you know, they see people of different races and different ethnicities kind of getting ahead while they seem to be falling behind.
So you think it's all relative, but maybe Don's just thinking, whatever's happening with anybody else, I'm just falling behind.
Right. I mean, this is a trouble when trying to, I think, generalize for like a handful of examples. I don't know. I can't say specifically what's in Don's mind or what's in Don's heart, but I can look at broad trends and broad groups of people and what surveys and data seem to indicate. And what they seem to indicate is that there are many white Americans who see things in sort of a racial zero sum, and that they're falling behind. And Trump is directly speaking to them. And Trump is not speaking to working class people of color who may have also fallen behind, who almost certainly did in the past 10 years, but nonetheless do not see in Trump much of a champion.
Molly, do you think there's any way, after all these months of the primary season, that Trump could turn around in the general election and broaden that appeal, or is that a done deal now, along racial lines?
I don't think we know, and I don't like to make predictions. But I mean, it seems unlikely just because Trump is a known quantity. He has pretty much 100% name ID, and we've seen in some of the protests surrounding his events when he's tried to go places like, a heavily African American inner city in Chicago or a heavily Latino area in California, that there have been these massive protests, which indicates, I think, the outpouring of animosity that he is inspired among the groups that were not voting in the Republican primary, as Jamel said. But I think if you were to make a sort of contrarian case for that, you would say, look how Trump sort of realigned, changed the battle lines of the Republican primary, took what was supposed to be a contest between sort of the Tea Party and the Republican establishment, and came in with a completely orthogonal sort of appeal, a third way, if you will, and reoriented the way Republican primary voters saw their loyalties. There might be a way to do that in a general election where, rather than unifying the Republican Party, Trump makes this appeal that, you know, he's a deal maker, he's going to get things done, he's going to disrupt the gridlocked and stale and ineffective system that we have in Washington, which I think most people are frustrated with.
Yep.
The question is, can he get the people he's offended to forget all the nasty things that he has said? And I think the Democrats' task is to ensure that he cannot.
And then, of course, there's the whole move to say, well, these two parties just can't respond to what the voters want. We need a third way. Here, this was Gary Johnson yesterday on ABC's This Week, former two-term governor of New Mexico, running for the Libertarian nomination, saying this year's election has an opening for a third-party candidate.
I think it is a real opportunity. I do think that Clinton and Trump are the two most polarizing figures in politics today. And when 50% of Americans now declare themselves as independent, I happen to think that they're libertarian. It's just that they don't know it.
Julia, what do you make of that? You've got the view of history here. Is there a third-party opportunity this year, or is it the same old American chemistry and structure that just makes that ultimately a fool's errand?
Well, it's really hard for third parties to win and gain any legitimacy in our system because it's set up as a winner-take-all system. And that's especially true at the presidential level. So I have to admit, I find it a little funny when people talk about what we need to unify us is additional parties. If we only had more parties, we would be more unified.
I don't know what you mean by that, actually, Julia.
So having... what would unify us would be having three or four parties instead of two.
So doesn't sound like it to me, but it would. But it would might give voice to people who do not feel they have voice in the current parties, and we've heard a lot from them this year.
Yeah, that is that is true, and I think that's a call for shifting around the ideological commitments and the terms of debate. And so one of the things I think has been most telling throughout this cycle is the attention to income inequality, which has been, it's kind of been part of the conversation in the last couple of elections, but not a main issue. Clearly, the Sanders candidacy got a lot of support, surprising support, I think, really took a lot of people by surprise. But also in the Republican debates early on in the fall, a lot of times the candidates were talking about inequality and about what to do about inequality. And to me, that suggests that, what's really happening is this Reagan system has kind of had its day. We go through, politics does tend to follow these 40-year cycles. And it's time for some new ideas. But the idea that we could sustain three or four parties and that would somehow get at the heart of what the people really want is not really, it's not really consistent with the evidence. We're not going to be able to sustain three or four parties. How bad and divisive would it be if we had a president that was elected with only 30% of the popular vote or goes to the House of Representatives? Our system is designed to create majorities in a big country, and that's important.
Let's go to Jeff in Bloomington, Illinois, my hometown. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to point out in the 40-plus years that I've been closely following politics, I have seen no difference between the parties. Doesn't matter who gets elected, Republican or Democrat, foreign policy stays the same, domestic policy stays the same, economic policy stays the same. You know why that is? It's because the people really don't care. They really don't know what's going on. They're not interested in it. They've got their own lives to deal with. And the people that really run this country, who you don't talk about, they don't want things to change. They want bigger government. They want more taxes. They want more spending. They want more control. That is the fact. And as pointed out, I've seen it time and time again. People in the media refuse to bring this up. I understand you want to keep your jobs. I get it.
Now you're going off my rails there, Jeff. We talk plenty about people in all kinds of elite positions in this country. Tune in. You will hear it. But Molly Ball, this is a message from the voting public we hear again and again. No matter what we feel, things don't change. And Jeff doesn't even see a difference between Republicans and Democrats. Do you see something changing in that chemistry this year? Do you see something that could jolt the whole conversation into a different place?
It certainly feels like that's what's happening. And look, this caller and the previous caller are right that there has been a sort of bipartisan conspiracy on certain issues. Trade is number one. You had the Obama administration Yep. working largely with Republicans in Congress on the TPP, and Democrats for decades have been campaigning against trade deals and then enacting them as soon as they get into office, from NAFTA to this latest one to a slew of previous trade deals done by this administration. So if you are one of these people who feels that these trade deals and more broadly the sort of dislocations caused by globalization are killing blue-collar jobs, which may or may not be true, then you really do not have a voice in the two major parties.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the evolution of consumer preferences to the reasons for price swings in the oil market, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what's next for American politics and our two-party system, asking if we are seeing right now a fundamental change, and if we are, what it might look like for the GOP and for the Democrats. Jamelle Bouie is with us, chief political correspondent for Slate. Molly Ball is here, political staff writer at The Atlantic. Her most recent article's headline, "The Day the Republican Party Died." Julia Azari is with us from Milwaukee and Marquette University there, contributes to 538 and Vox as well. You can join us. What do you think? Can these parties make the change that people are asking for? Or do they split up, crack up? Has the GOP cracked up already? What does that mean? Will the Democrats go left, be a different party when we're out of the woods here, or at least different than they've been lately? Republican tension, more than tension, very, very obvious. Here, House Speaker Paul Ryan, talking with CNN's Jake Tapper on Thursday, said he can't at the moment support his party's nominee, or apparently Donald Trump.
I'm just not ready to do that at this point. I'm not there right now. And I hope to, though, and I want to. But I think what is required is that we unify this party.
Democrats, what goes forward from all the energy that has flowed into Bernie Sanders' campaign? On Friday, he talked to Rachel Maddow, MSNBC. He said the Sanders movement will continue.
If I do not get elected president, are we going to continue the movement and work with our allies? Absolutely, we will.
Will you form an overt organization of some kind?
It's too early to say, because right now my mind is on the next nine primaries and caucus.
Too early to say if he'll form some other kind of organization to take the Sanders message forward. Rally in Chicago a couple months back, Sanders supporters talked to WHIO Radio about what they would do if Bernie isn't on the ballot in November.
Even if he loses, the movement doesn't stop. Like, we have to keep going from there. Vote for the Green Party, vote for the Socialist Party, vote for the Communist Party.
I don't really agree with voting for Hillary Clinton just because I don't like anything that she stands for.
I'm thinking Jill Stein. I might just write in Bernie.
But Hillary Clinton wants everybody to know she's capturing the biggest vote. Here she was on Face the Nation. This was in March.
You know, I've gotten more votes than anybody running on either side. I've gotten more votes than Donald Trump, although I'm sure he doesn't want to hear that.
Where are we headed here? Margaret in Moore, Oklahoma. Margaret, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I just have a little bit of a different slant on it. I think that the American people over the last two administrations have noticed how powerful Congress can be, and at times looking insensitive, being able to shut down the government, being able to make those trade deals, even though the Democrats have, you know, traditionally been against them. I think in some ways the American people are not cynical, and that the reason that we have a strong Bernie Sanders candidacy, even though the votes aren't there, and we have a strong Donald Trump candidacy, is symptomatic of the American people's belief that maybe with this extreme this extremism, this will wake up Congress and is really a representation that the American people are not cynical about the voting process, and I don't think they're particularly opposed to a two-party system, but I think this is a message that they're trying to send, and they feel like the extremes will get some fallout that will force what responsible people may be left in the legislative branch to do something.
To get going, Margaret, I'm really glad you put it that way. I mean, Molly, how about it? The polls have shown for years now America's on the wrong track. The popularity of Congress, rock bottom. I mean, in a democracy that's alive, those things should produce significant change.
Yeah, well, people are certainly pessimistic. And I do think
that's
that
they're different cynical than being cynical,
isn't it? About government. Well, yeah. I do think people are cynical about government, and that's where the low ratings for Congress come from. But I think the caller is referring to the sort of idealism that's powering the Bernie Sanders movement. And look, it's true that Sanders supporters are very idealistic, believing in the idea that this political revolution could actually happen. But it is also the case that they are relatively extreme, that in the spectrum of ideas from left to right in our political system, the Sanders philosophy is very far off to one end on the left. And so in that sense, you can see that even I think it would be a mistake to say, oh, the Democratic and Republican parties are both being disrupted. There's a very different phenomenon happening in the Republican Party, and we shouldn't call them equivalent. But it is true that both parties are at some level grappling with this decades-long phenomenon of polarization, where more and more Americans are clustering on the far right and the far left, and that is tugging the parties in different directions.
Yeah, but what does the far right even mean now? If it's not Reagan conservatism, that has been kind of the definition. I mean, Julia, what we're seeing here is something that looks more like a throwback conservatism, back to nationalism and the America First movement. This is back way, way before Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that I think is critical here is ideologies really are kind of ways of looking at the world that cobble together different positions, economic, social, foreign policy. As Molly was saying before, with the three-legged stool of conservatism, that's not what the Republican Party has necessarily historically stood for. And actually, Trump sounds a lot like some 19th century Republicans talking about protectionism and about national strength. Ideologies kind of get remixed and coalitions get remixed. I think the other trick with polarization and with what we're seeing going on, the splits within the two parties, is that both parties have some members who are higher income and some members who are lower income. Republicans tend to be higher income than Democrats on balance, but both parties have some economic diversity within them. And we are seeing some evidence that the interests of those two groups are not always the same, and they're kind of at odds now. And in particular, this theme has come up, as we've heard from several callers now, again and again, in the Trump movement, that working-class Republicans feel like, at least white working-class Republicans, as Jamel points out, feel like they're not being served by the interests of the party. I think the same thing may be going on for the Democrats.
I mean, I've got the latest numbers here. The Wall Street Journal looked at the Center for Responsive Politics. They're looking at where Wall Street donations are going. And they found that, the donations in March, Hillary Clinton got 53% of the donations from Wall Street, up from 32% last year. And it looks like Wall Street donors moving, who might have given to Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio before, going to her over Trump. I mean, they like stability. I want to look with you, Jamel, at what all this means for the Democratic Party. Here's one more of these Sanders supporters, Yene Indago, telling CNN last month she would support somebody else, maybe a third-party candidate, but not Hillary Clinton.
Is it true that you are Bernie or bust?
I'm definitely
Bernie
or bust.
If it is Hillary that is the candidate, you will not vote for Hillary?
I won't vote for Hillary. I can't vote for her.
Jamel, what is going to happen to all that energy we saw in the Democratic Party behind Bernie Sanders? Does it just flow to Hillary because it's Hillary or Donald, or is it something more complicated unfolding here? And what does it mean beyond even this election season for the Democratic Party? Is it redirecting as we speak?
Yeah, I think it depends on what Bernie Sanders decides to do. If Bernie Sanders decides that his best option for retaining influence in the Democratic Party, influence he's built over the course of the primary, if he decides that his best option for doing that is to full-throatedly support Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee, then I think a lot of this Bernie or bust sentiment will die down. Remember, in the 2008 primary, around this time, upwards of 50% of Clinton supporters said they wouldn't back Barack Obama in the general, and Hillary Clinton became a full-throated supporter of Obama in the summer, and that changed. And so I think a lot of this depends on what Sanders decides to do going forward from here into, you know, beyond this election. I think, again, it depends on what Sanders decides to do. There's a real opportunity for Sanders to encourage his supporters to begin building actual or stronger progressive infrastructure to begin to change or move the Democratic Party in the direction of this sort of like left-wing social democratic movement. I will say, and I think this is very important for trying to put both the Sanders movement and the Trump campaign into sort of a broader context, that both phenomena seem to be focused around America's, or at least a plurality of America's white voters. If you look at polls of where people, how people view the country, how people view life in America. A March poll from the Pew Research Center details this pretty well. If you ask voters of color, black and Hispanic voters, compared with 50 years ago, is life in America today better for people like you? Something like 58% of black voters say it is, 41% of Hispanics say it is, 14% of Hispanics say it's about the same, 17% of blacks say it's about the same, okay. But 28% of whites only say it's better, 54% of whites say it's worse. And so I think it's impossible to disentangle what's happening with these two campaigns from, I think, the very real changes in the social status and positioning of white voters. I don't think it's an accident that on the right, at the time that we've had a black president, there's been a sort of explosion in status for non-whites. You see the emergence of someone like Trump. And on the left, at a time when now even middle-class whites of any ideological persuasion have a harder time getting ahead, maintaining that middle-class status, that you see the emergence of sort of a social democratic movement that even within the Democratic Party is heavily concentrated among the party's white voters. If you do not directly tackle the racial aspect of this, you end up overgeneralizing what might be happening here.
I'm all for tackling that. I mean, we know what's happening with demographics. We know that the coloration of the country, the racial profile of the country is changing and will change more. But when that white population is affected, I mean, when opioids became big in the white population, suddenly you're hearing, don't put all drug users in jail. Now you've got this economic woe. It's hitting whites as well. Could that flow into, could that spark the change on the left that you're talking about here? And will it find an answering sympathy in voters of color, Jamel?
I think it could spark a change in the left, just depending on how it goes. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there is no nationally viable left-wing movement, much less liberal movement, without the full support of voters of color. African Americans in particular, and but Latinos as well, provide the crucial votes Democrats need to win national majorities. And so I think Sanders shows the limits of a kind of left-wing movement that is essentially rooted in sort of middle class and to some extent, but now I don't think it's great of an extent, left-leaning working class white discontent. I think that for something like that to be successful and sort of change the party at large, it needs to have not just appeal to, but in some sense rooted out of the at present plurality, but soon to be majority of Democrats who are not white. And if that happens, then I think the Democratic Party can change quite a bit. But for now, I think this is discontent that isn't quite mirrored are shared among all of the Democratic Party's constituent demographic groups. And then, in part because some of them are kind of on the ascent, and they don't feel like they're struggling as much.
Yep.
They don't feel like things are as bad.
How far would Bernie go to push his agenda? Would he bolt the Democratic Party? He made a promise last summer that he wouldn't with the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. I mean, after Donald Trump made that quip about how he ought to start a third-party candidate, his wife Jane said Bernie was sticking to his guns. That was his promise last summer. Let's listen back. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
For a lot of reasons, the only way at this particular moment in history that we could run an effective campaign was within the Democratic primary and caucus process, and that's what we're doing. So to answer your question, if it happens that I do not win that process, would I run outside of the system? No, I made the promise that I would not, and I'll keep that promise.
Of course, that was last summer. Bernie Sanders has seen a lot, and the country has since then. Molly Ball, I keep coming back to the Republicans, and I just can't see. I know some people are siding with Donald Trump now, and we know we see the votes that he's won, but it's hard for me to see with his challenge to conservatism, and we heard it again over the weekend. I'm a Republican, not a conservative, and unity doesn't matter. How on earth does this party hold together? The people who are true blue or red or whatever, Reagan conservatives, they're serious about it. They're not going to just go with whatever hits Donald when he gets up in the morning to do his hair.
No, they're not. I think Jamel made a really good point, and I just want to refine it a little bit. That what Trump and Sanders, I think, have in common is they are both change candidates who want to radically overthrow the status quo, who want to sort of yank it out by its roots and start over. Hillary Clinton is a status quo candidate. She's a candidate of pragmatic incrementalism who says we're on an okay path. We just need to keep working at it. And what we have seen in both of these movements is that most of the voters who want this radical change are white people. And most of the voters who believe that if we just keep working gradually at it, we can get there are people of color. The difference is those anti-status quo voters are the majority in the Republican Party, and they are a minority in the Democratic Party.
So bottom line, does the GOP hang together? I keep coming back to it. Do you think it can? Do you think Bill Kristol's going to suddenly warm up to Donald Trump?
No. And I have a hard time figuring out how you get this cat back in the bag. Now that it's out, even if Trump loses big, I don't think all of his followers or him himself are going to very easily be re-assimilated into the Republican Party. I don't see how they these millions of people collectively say sort of, well, guess we were wrong. We'll go back to that thing that you were trying to build. And all the people now ripping up their registrations, I don't see how they reconcile themselves to being in the same tent with those people. So I don't know where it goes, but it feels permanent to me.
Julia, again, perspective of history, the two parties endure. Do they endure this? Do they come out different cats?
Yeah, it's probably about time for one of them to really seriously reorganize. And like, as someone pointed out earlier, that hasn't happened for the Whigs, since the Whigs, but you know,
before the Civil War.
Yeah, exactly. Before the Civil War. I think the most likely outcome here is that we're going to see a couple cycles where we got a couple of different perspectives that are, out of what used to be the Republican coalition. I think there's a good chance we've got a regional southern wing of the Republican Party that kind of goes off on its own a little bit, as it did when it was part of the Democratic coalition. So I think we're looking at a period of very fractious politics.
Well, ferment is well and truly underway, and now it's got legs. Donald Trump, the apparent nominee already. Bernie Sanders still in there as the Democrats come down very late in the primary season now. Really terrific to hear from all three of you today. Jamelle Bouie at Slate, terrific to have you, Jamelle. Thank you for joining us so much.
Thank you for having me.
Molly Ball at The Atlantic, always great to have you, Molly. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Julia Azari, author of Delivering the People's Message at Marquette. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.